In 1947, deep in the Appalachian Hills of West Virginia, the name Pine Hollow carried a heavy silence. And that silence was really defined by two identical brothers who viewed the land and, tragically, anyone who crossed onto it as their absolute personal property.
And you have to remember the context. This is post-war, a geographically isolated pocket of the country, far from any real established legal oversight.
Right.
That kind of environment created the perfect conditions for a really localized form of terror to just take root.
Yeah, when you think about the infrastructure or lack of it, you know, poor roads, very limited communication.
Exactly. It meant that local fear became, in effect, the only form of law that mattered.
And that isolation is really the key to our deep dive today. We are examining some short, chilling excerpts that detail a very specific event.
A true life event.
It involves boundary lines, a county land surveyor, and the dark history of the Ketchum twins, Elmer and Roy.
Our focus here is almost forensic. We want to see how a seemingly simple, almost bureaucratic task.
Just marking a property line.
Yeah, how that devolved with this terrifying contained speed into a nightmare of just absolute unchecked dread.
We're really not looking at a chaotic crime here. This is about tracing the anatomy of something systemic.
It is. The sources we have, they suggest that the local fear was so potent the community actively self-quarantined around the threat.
They built an invisible wall.
They did.
Yeah.
And this allowed a horrifying pattern of behavior to thrive for years. It took the intervention of an outside force. This surveyor, Caleb Henson,
a county official,
an official representing objective law and order, to inadvertently expose the core of their operation.
Only for him to immediately, you know, vanish right into it.
Mm-hmm.
We have these crucial excerpts detailing the events in Pine Hollow, West Virginia, October 1947. And these notes aren't just about a crime. They're like a narrative arc.
They show the complete breakdown of external jurisdiction and the violent assertion of a private sovereign power.
It's compelling material because for you, the listener, it forces you to confront where real power actually lies when the map ends.
Right. It explores that concept of absolute ownership, not just of the acreage, but the ownership the twins assorted over the very concepts of justice, silence, and fear within their domain.
They were the law.
They were the ultimate authorities.
Okay, let's unpack this. We'll be breaking down the key steps that transformed the Ketchum property from just a neglected farm into a bona fide forbidden zone.
A zone maintained by silence, by physical barriers, and this synchronized, cold-blooded psychological control.
So we have to start with the environment that enabled them. The place itself.
To really understand the Ketchum incident, you have to immediately situate yourself in the reality of 1947 rural Appalachia. The geography of isolation isn't just background scenery.
No, it's an active participant.
It's the enabler of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
The source specifically places the location deep in the hills near Pine Hollow, West Virginia.
And that detail that is deep in the hills is so crucial. In the immediate post-war period, you know, infrastructure investment just hadn't reached these areas.
Not at all. There was no easy access. We're talking about roads that were barely passable dirt track.
Right. So a trip from the county seat where the sheriff's office would be, that's a difficult multi-hour journey, maybe even a full day affair if the weather turned.
Exactly. And that remoteness essentially meant the area operated outside typical municipal or state oversight simply because of logistical impossibility.
When law enforcement takes half a day to even get there.
The effective jurisdiction of the county sheriff just shrinks to almost zero. Any criminal activity that happens quickly or in secret has this massive head start.
The land itself starts to enforce its own rules just through the difficulty of, you know, getting through it.
That's it. And what do we find nestled in this difficult terrain? The physical anchor of the whole operation.
The farmhouse.
The twins shared a decaying farmhouse on a large, isolated property. That structure isn't just old, it's a physical manifestation of neglect and detachment from societal norms.
That decay is the first clue. It tells you that whatever happened there happened slowly, away from observation. It was sustained by a lack of intervention.
You know, a decaying structure often indicates poverty or abandonment, but here it seems to be a chosen detachment.
How so?
Well, the Ketchums weren't just suffering from neglect. Their property was, it seems, actively neglected because they rejected the outside world and its demands for order. That decay acts as its own barrier.
Like a form of camouflage.
A perfect camouflage. It tells any casual traveler or county worker, stay away, this place is not worth the effort.
Okay, so let's define the central figures here. Elmer and Roy Ketchum. They're described simply as identical twin brothers. But why does their identical nature matter so much in a small town?
It creates a psychological force multiplier. I mean, in a rural area where your reputation is everything, having two identical figures behaving aggressively creates this perpetual uncertainty.
You can never be sure which one you saw.
Exactly. You don't know which twin delivered the threat, which one you saw near the property line, or if the one you're looking at is acting alone.
It blurs their individual identity.
It does. It lets them function as a single, unified, unpredictable, and potentially everywhere unit. It doubles the perceived threat without doubling the number of people you have to track.
That idea of a unified force is... It's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It removes individual accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So if one twin assaults you, it's not just an individual crime. It's a declaration of force by their entire domain.
And the sources confirm they were known troublemakers. This establishes a history of conflict that the town was already, you know, very familiar with.
And their criminal profile is really the source of the community's learned helplessness. Mm-hmm. Petty theft, assaults, short jail stays that never lasted.
That is the crucial pattern. They were constantly crossing minor legal boundaries, borderline misdemeanor stuff, and they'd receive minor consequences and then return immediately to the same behavior.
Which suggests the justice system was just utterly incapable of containing them.
Completely.
Their crimes were just irritating enough to get them a brief arrest, maybe a fine, maybe a weekend in the county lockup.
But never serious enough, or maybe more importantly, never provable enough to impose any kind of long-term incarceration or supervision.
It creates this predictable cycle of impunity.
It does. The community sees the twins commit crimes, watches them get released quickly, and sees them immediately go back to it.
And that teaches the townsfolk a pretty grim lesson.
A very grim lesson.
Yeah.
The law, when it's applied to the Ketchums, is ineffective, it's temporary, and it's easily circumvented.
So the real threat isn't the stake or the law?
No. The real threat is the twins themselves. And so the community begins to self-regulate around that perceived threat, rather than relying on any outside authorities.
And we can't overlook the essential organizational element in that house, Moss Ketchum, the twins' aunt.
Mm-hmm.
She's described specifically as silent and controlling. What is the role of this silent figure in all this?
Ma Ketchum is the domestic infrastructure. That's the only way to put it. The twins provide the muscle, the aggression, the acquisitions. Ma Ketchum provides the continuity, the organizational structure, and the quiet sanction.
The word controlling is key.
It is. It means she holds real authority. She was likely managing the logistics, the cooking, the cleaning, perhaps even the maintenance of the security of the cellar.
Her silence is arguably more important than the twins' noise.
I would agree with that. Silence suggests deep complicity, the intentional refusal to acknowledge the systematic crimes happening under her own roof. She's the gatekeeper.
The one who ensures the outside world's morality and rules just can't penetrate the walls.
She's the regulatory framework for their whole system of horror. Without her silence and her control, the chaos might have been less systemic, more random, easier to detect.
But her presence implies an organized system.
A system of feeding, sheltering, and continuous maintenance of their ongoing captivity operation. It elevates the farmhouse from just a criminal lair to a structured prison facility.
And that structure led directly to how the town reacted, which was through what the source calls active avoidance.
Mm-hmm. People avoided the property.
This wasn't just a passive thing. This was a conscious, proactive, protective measure the whole community adopted. They understood the local fatal terms of engagement.
The property was functionally quarantined by its neighbors' own fear. They drew an invisible boundary line, a local cordon sanitaire, long before any surveyor arrived.
The community basically ceded jurisdiction to the twins.
They did, because the cost of asserting their own rights was just too high.
And the terrifying piece of knowledge the town had, the real source of the fear, is this chilling line from the source.
I know the one.
Anyone who wandered too close usually didn't come back.
Right. And that implies the community understood the fatal consequences of crossing that invisible, fear-based boundary long before the county ever decided to intervene on paper.
That's why the collective silence is so profound. The community's avoidance essentially codified the property as an unregulated fatal zone.
This collective decision to look away ceded all jurisdiction to the twins. The failure of the official law was reinforced by the community's own decision to adopt a protective distance.
An atmosphere of absolute impunity.
And that atmosphere is precisely what made the subsequent events, the systematic capture of outsiders, not only possible, but, you know, inevitable.
And it is at this exact point when fear has established a perimeter and isolation has cemented the rules, that the outside world decides to intervene.
In the form of objective bureaucratic authority.
Which sets the stage for the fatal dispute.
Mm-hmm.
The catalyst for this whole discovery is the arrival of external authority in the form of Caleb Henson, the land surveyor.
And he arrives with a mandate that is objective and official. He was sent by the county.
So he's bringing the outside world's concept of fixed, immutable order lines on a map into the Ketchum's intensely subjective and violently flexible world.
Caleb Henson is not just an employee. He is, by his very profession, an agent of established order. He represents deeds, legal boundaries, the impartial application of property law.
His tools.
His tools, like the transit and the Gunter's chain, they're instruments of precision designed to eliminate subjective interpretation. His job is literally to define where one property ends and another begins.
A foundational concept of civilized society.
Right. And he didn't just show up randomly. He arrived because there were specific motivating factors.
Reports of boundary disputes and missing livestock.
And the inclusion of missing livestock tells you a lot about the escalation of the twins' activities. It signals a critical threshold. Petty assault, minor theft, that's often handled locally or just dismissed. But missing livestock, that's tangible economic harm.
The disappearance of cattle or hogs.
Critical assets in a rural economy. This forces the county to intervene officially. The boundary dispute was the administrative mechanism they chose to assert jurisdiction.
Because livestock theft suggests crossing property lines.
Which falls under the surveyor's purview. The county was essentially trying to assert its authority through the objective application of geometry, using the landline as a proxy for the law.
So they were trying to solve a crime problem with a map.
They were. And that attempt to impose objective jurisdiction immediately clashes with the twins' established subjective rule.
The scene of arrival itself is just, designed to heighten the tension. Caleb arrived just before sunset.
And that detail about the timing is often dismissed as just atmospheric, but it's critical.
Why?
Well, surveying requires good light, clear lines of sight. Caleb was likely rushing to stake a final line before daylight faded.
See, he's vulnerable.
He is. This transition from the safety of bright day, when authorities might operate, to the vulnerability of twilight, when rational order gives way to primal danger, that marks his entry into the Ketchum's jurisdiction.
He arrived right as the Ketchum property was asserting its full, terrifying atmosphere, and the initial confrontation was entirely nonverbal.
The twins watched him work in silence.
Imagine that scene. If you, the listener, put yourself in Caleb's position, you're concentrating on precision, using your expensive, delicate instruments.
The transit, the tripod. You're focused on technical work.
And you're aware you're being watched by two identical, synchronized, unreadable figures. Completely still.
They aren't heckling him. They're not debating. They are assessing him. Like a piece of prey or an intruder into their private domain.
That silence is so effective. It conveys this immense, internalized certainty of their impending threat.
It's the stillness that makes it terrifying. It suggests patience and, worse, coordination.
And this tension finally breaks with the verbal conflict, which leads to Caleb's fatal misjudgment.
He tries to use bureaucracy as a shield.
Right. He explained he was marking county lines, framing his actions as necessary, lawful. He assumes the twins respect the rule of law as much as he does.
And that is the root of his failure to survive. He operated under the assumption of a shared reality.
The problem is, the Ketchums had created their own reality.
Mm-hmm. Elmer's response is direct, chilling, and it completely ignores the legal argument. You're taking what's ours.
We really need to unpack that statement. It goes beyond the surveyed property line being slightly off.
Oh, way beyond that.
It reflects their broader psychopathic view of absolute totalitarian ownership over the entire domain, including the air above it, the earth below it.
And anyone who enters it, their definition of ours is boundless.
It includes the land, the stolen livestock.
And most importantly, the people who trespass on it. For the Ketchums, law is not a set of external objective rules defined by the county. Law is their unilateral, violent will.
So a county line crossing their property isn't a legal matter.
No, it's an act of existential aggression against their sovereignty.
And this leads to the tragic central misjudgment. Caleb laughed it off and kept measuring. That was the mistake.
Why did he laugh? He wasn't necessarily arrogant, but he was dismissive.
He was a man of objective reality, dismissing a genuine threat as local eccentricity.
Or just the rambling of two uneducated mountain men. He literally could not conceive of a reality where his county-mandated markers held less power than the raw, organized violence of the twins.
That laugh was his declaration of faith in the system he represented.
It was. But by laughing, he showed contempt for their private system of rule, a system the entire town had already acknowledged through fear.
The twins didn't need to argue the point with him further.
No. The objective law had mocked the subjective sovereign, and the consequence was immediate. They simply acted on their own definition of the boundary violation, asserting their supreme physical authority.
The rule of law collided with the rule of brute force.
And brute force won. Instantly. Caleb's tools of measurement were suddenly useless against the absolute, immediate nature of the Ketchum's response.
The narrative transitions here with just brutal efficiency.
Hmm.
The negotiation is over, the sun is down, and the dread becomes palpable.
That night, Caleb Henson was dragged into the cellar beneath the farmhouse.
It's such a rapid shift from an open public dispute in the yard to a sealed secret confinement deep inside their private world.
And the efficiency of that action just confirms the twins' organization. They didn't have to debate where to put him or how to secure him. They knew exactly where to go.
The decaying farmhouse, which looked like a simple homestead, immediately transforms into a well-oiled prison facility.
The cellar is the perfect choice. Hidden, naturally cool, easily secured, and directly beneath their daily routine, which reinforces McKechum's role as the quiet overseer of this domestic terror.
And what Caleb finds down there transforms the entire scale of the situation. This is the cellar reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Down in the absolute darkness, Caleb found others.
That's the critical moment. This is where the narrative changes from a singular crime, a surveyor disappearing during a land dispute, to the uncovering of a systematic ongoing operation.
And the specific identification of the victims is what's truly chilling.
Men from nearby towns all reported missing over the previous year.
That is crucial. It elevates the Ketchum incident far beyond a localized assault. This transforms the event into the exposure of a long-term coordinated process of capture and sustained confinement.
And think about the implications of the victims being from nearby towns. This suggests a radius of operation.
Right. The Ketchums weren't just preying on local Pine Hollow folks who wandered too close.
No, they were likely venturing out or at least attracting people from a wider area and successfully making them vanish without anyone connecting the dots.
It reveals a massive failure of regional law enforcement to correlate multiple geographically dispersed missing persons reports.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, the boundary dispute was not the motive for grabbing Caleb.
No, it was the mechanism.
Exactly. It was the mechanism by which Caleb Henson was acquired. The motive seems to be the establishment and maintenance of this secret system of control. Caleb was acquired because he asserted jurisdiction. The others were acquired through. Who knows?
Theft, trespassing, maybe they were lured in.
And the cellar was the undeniable physical evidence of the systematic horror that the surrounding community had been living under and crucially ignoring for an entire year.
The duration of confinement implied here, reported missing over the previous year, that's the most important logistical detail.
It is. It suggests the twins were holding captives for extended periods, pointing toward a grim established routine. This isn't a spontaneous act of violence. It required significant planning and sustained effort.
A routine requires structure.
And structure points right back to Mike Ketchum. Who managed the logistics? Food, water, waste disposal, continuous security. If you have multiple captives for over 12 months, you need an organization that goes beyond just two aggressive brothers.
The farmhouse functioned as a self-contained, unregulated governance zone where they dictated the very terms of survival.
And this duration profoundly highlights the societal tolerance of the unknown in these isolated areas. For a year, the towns accepted the missing persons reports as, what? Inevitable accidents, people moving on.
Falling into the vastness of the Appalachian wilderness.
Right. The Ketchums benefited immensely from the general assumption that the wilderness itself was the threat, not the decaying farmhouse nestled right in the middle of it.
So the surveyor, the man of objective measurement, is now trapped in the ultimate subjective nightmare.
Surrounded by the physical, undeniable proof of the community's generalized fear.
But after the terror of the descent and the chilling reveal of the system, the twins return with an offer.
An offer that seems almost calculatedly banal, yet is completely predatory. This is a masterclass in psychological manipulation.
Yeah. What kind of game were they running by mixing absolute terror with the promise of, you know, normal domestic labor?
Well, this shift in approach is a deliberate psychological turn. After they establish absolute control through overwhelming violence and the visual evidence of the cellar, the twins switched to manipulation and conditional hope.
Days later, the twins returned with an offer. They needed help fixing the fence out back, a chance to earn freedom.
The task itself is the epitome of cruel banality fence fixing. This is classic everyday rural maintenance set against the backdrop of a cellar where men have been held captive for a year.
They're forcing the captive to participate in maintaining the very boundary that trapped them.
Exactly. Suggesting that obedience might somehow redefine the rules, it's a profound act of psychological cruelty.
It's a test of obedience.
A perverse form of rehabilitation, forcing the captive to accept the twins' rules as the only path forward. The work, fixing the boundary line, ironically solidifies the twin's territorial claim, using the victim's own efforts against him.
It presents a simple, clear transaction. Obey the task, maintain the boundaries we define, and maybe you can earn something.
And this highlights the twins' internal confidence. They are so certain of their control that they're willing to introduce risk-bringing Caleb upstairs because they believe their psychological dominance and the environment are sufficient to contain any escape attempt.
So how did Caleb Hansen react?
Caleb agreed.
And you have to analyze this not as weakness, but as just desperate survival instinct.
Absolutely. He is an educated, professional man. But when you're faced with systemic, organized terror, you take the only path presented, regardless of how transparently dangerous that hope appears.
He's realized that his tools, his authority, his county mandate.
None of it matters.
Only the twins' arbitrary rules matter now. His agreement is a strategic concession. He's playing their game to get out of the cellar and potentially find a moment of vulnerability.
A loophole. That's exactly what he's looking for. And that exposure leads immediately to the escape attempt, the point of maximum tension.
At the top of the cellar stairs, he ran.
This is the ultimate rejection of the twin system. He seizes the opportunity the moment the domestic facade of fence fixing gave him.
But the house itself was the true trap. He runs for the most obvious route to freedom.
The front door.
Only to be met by the quick, brutal realization the front door wouldn't open.
And this confirms the premeditation. The fence fixing was the lure to get him to cooperate and come upstairs. The locked door was the cage, ensuring that any break for self-preservation was contained within their immediate sphere of control.
The escape attempt itself was just the final test in their twisted psychological contract.
The house wasn't just decaying. It was actively secured against outside intrusion and inside escape.
The climax of the entire narrative rests on this final moment of confrontation. The source describes as hands closed in on him.
It captures that overwhelming, synchronized physical presence of the two identical figures. The chase is short, immediate, and overwhelming.
And then the denouement. The climax is auditory and psychological, not just physical. The chilling final line delivered simultaneously with perfect synchronization.
You cross the line.
This line is the thesis statement of the entire narrative. It summarizes their jurisdiction, their methodology, and their total violent lack of accountability to external law.
Let's break down that double meaning because it encapsulates the collision of the two worlds. First, there's the literal boundary line.
Right. Caleb is sent to mark county lines. That was his profession.
But in his desperate escape, he crossed the internal line. The threshold between the house's interior and the exterior world, a line the twins had explicitly, violently defined as forbidden.
And second, and far more critical, is the conceptual line.
Yes. Caleb had crossed the social, moral, and physical line defined entirely by the Ketchum twins themselves.
He crossed it by entering their property in the first place. He crossed it by failing to heed the town's silent warning.
And finally, he crossed it by rejecting their conditional offer of labor and attempting to escape their jurisdiction.
This unison line is the twins' declaration of absolute jurisdiction. It's the final sentence of their private justice system.
And the fact that they speak it together just reinforces that terrifying concept that they are a single, unified, implacable source of authority on their property.
They are one entity.
One entity issuing one final, unappealable verdict. It's the sound of two individuals functioning as one judge, one jury, and one executioner.
It implies they had perfected the synchronization of their predatory movements and their judgment.
Mm-hmm. The county line, the objective fact of the law, was totally irrelevant. The only line that mattered was the one the Ketchums decided was there.
This raises the essential question we have to carry forward. In a geographically isolated world where law and order are distant logistical burdens, who gets to define the boundaries?
The twins didn't just own the land. They enforced their own personalized justice system, which hinged entirely on this final declaration. The crossing of their line meant immediate, absolute forfeiture of life or freedom.
The twins successfully replaced civil law with absolute, immediate retaliation, and Caleb Hansen, the symbol of external order, became a permanent part of the inventory of the Ketchum farm. He was assimilated into the silence. We've traced a chilling, detailed journey today, from a mundane county boundary dispute rooted in missing livestock,
all the way to the uncovering of a sophisticated systemic captivity operation run by twin brothers operating with absolute impunity in isolated West Virginia.
The enduring synthesis of this event rests on the powerful, corrosive role of silence and the terrifying efficiency of synchronization.
Right. Silence, maintained by Mike Ketchum, provided the domestic cover. And tragically, the community's own act of avoidance amplified the terror, allowing the operation to continue for over a year.
And the synchronization, the identical nature of the twins and that unison line, served as the ultimate physical and psychological weapon. It ensured that when the final judgment was delivered, it was absolute and unified.
So what does this systematic failure of jurisdiction mean for you, the listener? The Ketchum story is a chilling reminder that isolation doesn't just breed eccentricity. It can breed a unique kind of absolute lawlessness where self-imposed fear replaces state-imposed order.
The system fails, not necessarily through incompetence, but through collective protective silence, the moment the neighbors decide it's safer to look away.
When a place is defined by the practical absence of objective law, those who are willing and organized enough to assert continuous force become the sovereign authority.
The boundary dispute was meaningless. The true boundaries were defined by the capacity for violence and the willingness to enforce a definition of ownership that, horrifyingly, included human beings.
The surveyor, Caleb Hansen, became just another person reported missing, assimilated into the property's dark history. The literal county boundary line he tried to mark was forgotten the moment he crossed the Ketchum's conceptual line.
But the town of Pine Hollow carried the true heavy evidence, not in ledgers or maps, but in the sustained, collective, and terrifying memory of the silence they kept.
The deep knowledge that no one talks about what lies beneath that decaying farmhouse.
The greatest horror here is not what was done in the cellar, but the fact that the entire surrounding world agreed to forget what happened when the surveyor laughed, allowing the Ketchum line to stand unchallenged.